Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Tasha Robinson,
Genevieve Kosky,
Scott Tobias.
Here on The Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film, consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, we have two films about kids and their bonds with powerful creatures. One creature is real and one is imaginary, but both films focus on what their relationship means to both kid and animal. But the similarities between our two choices go even deeper. Tasha, now that I've won your trust by luring you into the studio with food, can you tell us a little bit about these movies?
Yeah, you're not giving me enough credit for having saved your life by stomping on that snake. This week we all saw Pete's Dragon, David Lowery's new remake of the 1977 Disney film of the same name, albeit one that only resembles its source in the broadest possible strokes. Pete's Dragon stars Oakes Fegley as the eponymous Pete, a kid left alone in the forest when his parents experience a car accident in a remote wooded area. He's adopted by a dragon he names Elliot, and years later, both boy and dragon have to adapt when he's discovered by a kindly forest ranger played by Bryce Dallas Howard, who grew up hearing tales of dragons from her father, played by Robert Redford. We entertain a few possible companion films to Pete's Dragon, but when we happen upon an IndieWire interview with Lowery in which he mentioned Carol Ballard's 1979 film The Black Stallion as a source of inspiration, we didn't have to entertain anymore. If The Black Stallion was made today, Lowery told writer Bill Dezewitz, it would be an art house movie. But when I was growing up, that was family entertainment. I do wish those lines weren't so clearly drawn. I wish there was a little more art in the mainstream and a little more mainstream in the art sometimes.
So we decided to put The Black Stallion, a mainstream hit in 1979, next to Pete's Dragon, a film very much attempting to summon the same artful spirit. Both are visual feasts, both are anchored by remarkable performances from child actors, and both emphasize visuals over language to convey why we love animals and how deep that love can go. So, without further ado, let's board a doomed ship somewhere in the Mediterranean that's loaded with some cargo that doesn't want to be there.
The Black Stallion. The story of a legendary horse who could only be tamed by a young boy's love. Together, they survive a shipwreck. And the dangers of an island wilderness.
You saved my life.
They meet a forgotten man.
He'll be moving, he'll be making that rhythm. You just go on with him, see?
Who helps them bring a legend to life.
I've seen a horse that defies the imagination, that runs like a demon possessed, that speeds beyond belief. It would be the greatest sensation in racing history.
The Black Stallion. An unforgettable adventure, a motion picture of extraordinary beauty, a story that will make your heart race, your spirit soar. But most of all, it will make you believe in the Black Stallion.
It's usually a mistake to read too much of a director's biography into his or her career, but it's almost always a mistake to read none of that biography into it. take Carol Ballard, who followed an unlikely but weirdly logical path to directing The Black Stallion and the films he made after it, films like Never Cry Wolf and Fly Away Home, each of which returned to the theme of humanity's relationship with nature in general and animals in particular. Ballard was born in Los Angeles in 1937, but described his childhood to critic Scott Foundas as being spent in a frontier, pretty much a wilderness area, experiencing the world in a very direct way. He first became interested in film while serving in the Army, a stint that exposed him to movies by Akira Kurosawa, Sajid Ray, and Tenosuke Kinugasa's Gate of Hell. This interest took him to film school at UCLA, where he studied beside and befriended Francis Ford Coppola. But success didn't come as quickly for Ballard as it did for his classmate. Rather than pursuing big studio features, Ballard created short educational films like Pigs, a wordless exploration of the lives of pigs on a farm, and The Perils of Priscilla, the adventures of a runaway cat, which he made for the Pasadena Humane Society. Ballard had a busy, if not necessarily high-profile or prosperous filmmaking career, one that included some desert work on a little film called Star Wars, when Coppola called on him to direct an adaptation of Walter Farley's 1941 children's novel, The Black Stallion, the story of a boy who shipwrecked alongside a horse and later rides that horse to win a championship. Even if Ballard seemed like an odd pick at the time, it now looks like the film he'd trained his whole life to make. In his years making movies with animals, Ballard had learned the value of patience. At the heart of the film is a long, dialogue-free sequence in which Alec, a boy traveling with his father in the 1940s, is shipwrecked in a terrifying accident at sea and awakens on a desert island with the ship's only other survivor, a magnificent, seemingly untamable black stallion. Alec, played by Kelly Reno, slowly wins over the horse he dubs simply the Black, a process that culminates in a series of beautiful scenes of boy and horse living side by side, all boundaries between humanity and nature having seemingly been erased. Let's consider for a moment the virtually miraculous alignment that had to take place for one of the film's most famous moments, an unbroken take in which Alec finally wins over Black's trust as the sun sets. Ballard had to coax amazing performances out of both a kid and a horse, while working with cinematographer Caleb Deschanel to keep both in frame. And he had to do it all at magic hour, lest he lose the moment's visual richness. When Ballard finally does cut, it's to a closer shot that gives it an already emotionally raw moment the ideal punctuation. Yet each time I watch The Black Stallion, I don't think about any of this. I can imagine that there are piles upon piles of alternate takes of this and many of the film's other scenes, but it plays as unforced. It's a perfect moment, but it doesn't seem like the work of a controlling perfectionist. It plays like the work of someone who's spent a life watching animals and knowing that attempting to force nature to do your will is a fool's game. The best you can do is bend its direction a bit, and even then it's best to be prepared should it want to bend the other way. It's a case of the director's style lining up with the theme of the film. Working from a script by Melissa Matheson, Gene Rosenberg, and William D. Whitliff, Ballard keeps circling back to the foolishness of trying to turn an animal against its nature. The horse traders who beat and confine the Black in the film's opening moments have no shot at taming him, but Alec's kindness can. Penned in Alex's backyard upon their return, the Black rebels. When Alec channels his spirit toward racing, with the help of a down-on-his-luck trainer played by Mickey Rooney, he becomes an unlikely champion. And at this point, Ballard cuts not to a scene of roaring crowds, their faces shocked at what's happened, but flashes back to Alec astride the Black on that beach. Not only is there no getting to that moment of victory without the hours of patience and kindness that preceded it, the two are one and the same. So guys, The Black Stallion. We were all very excited about picking this film, enthused about pairing it with Pete's Dragon. Having watched it again, what did you all think?
Well, I hadn't seen it before. I was the only one who hadn't
seen
it.
All right, let's start with you then, Genevieve. What did you think of the film, The Black Stallion?
I really loved half of it and sort of liked the other half.
And I
think you can probably guess which is which.
That's a split I definitely want to talk about.
But I watched it after we had come up with this pairing, and after seeing Pete's Dragon, I was really thrilled by what a great pairing it ended up being, just for a lot of the stuff that you talked about in your keynote, but also just specifically how focused both films are on their visuals. And I like when we get to talk about visuals on this podcast, because I don't think we get to do it that much.
I mean, we get to talk about whatever we want.
That's true. That's true. But like I said, this is my first time watching it. Did any of you watch this as children?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay.
Many times.
So I'm more interested in that than hearing about it, a 32-year-old watching it for the first time.
Well, I think, I don't know if I saw it until it was on television. I remember it being on television quite a bit. And for a while, it really being
a staple. It was a family entertainment staple, for sure.
Yeah, and then kind of not even really thinking about it that much for a long time. And then when Criterion put it out on Blu-ray, I was really excited to revisit it. And it's even better than I remember it. And it's the second time I watched it, like in the last year or so, because I wrote about it for a piece in the Daily Beast last summer. And I kind of had the same reaction as you the first time I watched it in the last year. But watching it this time, I really liked the way the two halves fit together. The second half is a little more conventional, but it's still, it feels very much like the same movie to me.
Yeah, so I mean, I saw this film many times as a kid, and I think I recall as a kid, you know, being into sports, really enjoying the end of the movie, because I think the racing scene at the end is really one of the more thrilling sports movie endings ever. You know, it just happens to be in a movie where you have this just standalone, you know, masterpiece of a first half to compare with it. You know, so as an adult, I guess maybe you'd weigh the two and come out a little bit more on the side of the first half. But I love this film. I love Carol Ballard's, you know, vision as a director of family films. And it's just, I think there's something very pure about the way he pares everything down and the tone of his films and the simplicity of them and, you know, the emotions. It's just, it's all very elemental in a way that's just always appealed to me as both a child with this film and then as adult with movies like Fly Away Home.
I mean, elemental is just a really good way to put it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that I saw Black Stallion the first time in the theater and then probably again when it came to home video, and then just not for a really long time. But the second, I forget which of the two of you suggested it, but I mean, it was like a penny dropping home just in terms of what Pete's Dragon is doing.
Oh, yeah.
And just how perfect
it was.
Match
an instant,
this is.
It was an instant yes on the Black Stallion.
Yeah. Sure. And then just the chance to revisit because I remember it so warmly. I mean, much like Genevieve, I love the first half and I like the second half okay. But I mean, I just remember like watching it the first time. And this was the era where Disney was putting out films like The Apple Dumpling Gang and the original Pete's Dragon.
I was going to say, or Pete's Dragon.
Exactly. Which were just very squawky and shrill and performative. And, you know, the kids' performances in particular were very, look at me, I am saying words. And this film, I mean, this film feels like a documentary, you know? It feels like Ballard just kind of like landed on this island with his kid and his horse and watched them. It's so... watching it as an adult, you can feel the effort that must have gone into it. Reading up on it, you can certainly see the effort that must have gone into it, but it feels so effortless. It feels so natural and primal. The performances that he gets out of both the kid and the large series of horses that portray the black hare are just really, really organic.
That's certainly true of the sequences on the island, but before we get too far away from it, I want to talk about the shipwreck sequence, which I think is probably one of the most harrowing shipwrecks I've ever seen on film, and I was kind of in awe of that because it's not the image I had of this film going into it, which is because I'd seen clips before of that stuff we're talking about on the island, that very kind of beautiful, peaceful, organic, I guess, vibe. What struck me so much about that shipwreck sequence is how you felt the chaos, but you could also follow every beat of what was happening.
Yeah, and just, I mean, the scene where his father says goodbye and mm-hmm. you realize he's never going to see him again. Yeah. He's got a guy cutting the life jacket off of him. The sense of danger could not be any more intense.
It's that sequence where the guy grabs him, the black's owner grabs him and starts just methodically cutting him out of the life jacket is so chilling because you've got a natural disaster going on just in terms of like the water sheeting down and the storm and there's fire in the background. And then that's compounded by all of the people who keep bashing into him, knocking him down. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of all this, you have this just really directed, petty bit of selfish, malevolent evil. It's just so many things all on top of each other. And, you know, as you say, it's very clearly choreographed, but it's also just, what an overwhelming situation to be a small child.
Who wouldn't cut the jacket off
of
that kid?
And then add a wild horse to the equation, because it wasn't scary enough.
Really fantastic sound design in that scene, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. Like, you can see how small that set is. Mm-hmm. You know, the camera barely moves out of a fairly small area and a fairly directed angle on all of the chaos. You can see, like, where the water effect, you know, where they're dumping the water to make the splashes. And it just still, it feels reckless. Like, the people slamming into Alec don't feel like they're protecting him as a child actor. Like, he really does feel slammed around in that situation. And there's so many situations in this movie where if you read up on it, like, oh, the horse was fine and there was no danger. But, I mean, this film just looks like they mm-hmm. were endangering both the kid and the horse over and over and over.
It's like, how did they do that? The movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also credit, and this is true of Pete's Dragon, and it's true of Fly Away Home, of starting a movie with a parent dying. And that's a bold choice. I mean, that sets a tone and gets us to a pretty vulnerable place emotionally, right along with this kid. And it's not, I guess it's common in Disney animated films, but I don't know if it's all that common in live action films to have a parent die, especially in that so striking and powerful a way. I mean, it really, he's lingering quite a bit on the sequence. The sequence is pretty drawn out, the shipwreck. If you remember Fly Away Home, I mean, the entire opening credit sequence is pretty much a car flipping over and, you know, his mother dying. I mean, it's all done, not super explicit, but it is pretty heartbreaking to watch. And Pete's Dragon has that, you know, again, slows things down. It really lingers on this traumatic event. And I appreciate the courage to do that.
Well, there's also the fact that they take the time to establish the relationship between Alec and his dad.
Yeah.
They take the time to make him not only a real character that you're going to be sad to lose, but someone with like a meaningful relationship to his son. You know, Disney has a lot of dead parents in the background, but they're usually, you know, Bambi's mom and Simba's dad aside, they're usually just kind of backgrounded, you know. Mm-hmm. Dumbo's dad's not around, but we're not going to question why that is. It happened a long time ago and who knows where. This becomes very personal. You take the time to establish that Alec's dad likes him and makes him feel special and important and knows what he's interested in and takes time for him, and then you take him away.
In contrast to his mom, who we meet in the second half, who it's kind of an interesting reversal of your expected parental types there, because she just seemed really... like, okay, do whatever you want, go play with your horse. She's like very unengaged or unconcerned mother.
It always strikes me how there's not a whole effort to track Alec down when he disappears for a day or something.
Exactly.
I mean, he's already disappeared months.
They have the scene though. The two things. One, they have. I mean, they have a scene where she's talking to her kid about riding in the race and about him needing to ride in the race. So I thought that was a beautiful scene. And then one of my favorite moments in the movie is when he's sleeping outside with the horse, and she thanks the horse for saving her son. It's like the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. I love it. These are two really good parents.
Maybe that character is just a little underserved. Like, I'm certainly not insinuating that she was a bad mom, but
you can insinuate it. I mean, I think Keith is right. Like, her kid runs off literally down the middle of the street, and she says, "Alec, come back," and then doesn't go after him.
I always think it's kind of poetic license, I think.
There's another thing too. I mean, and this gets into the nature of parenting in that period. It's parenting in the 1940s is not like parenting in the 21st century.
You don't let your kids.
My father, when he was a boy, he says he can't believe he even survived his childhood. they were making bombs and playing around electrical wire.
But so, were they racing horses?
Were they racing bombs?
But it is a similar, just kind of like let the kids go and see what happens. But
are they making horse
I mean, obviously,
bombs?
If they're missing for that long, I just, what I'm saying is, like, I think we're underrating Terry Garr as a mom. I think this is a good home he's coming from.
I think you're conflating like insulting Alec's mom with insulting Terry Garr.
I love Terry Garr.
Okay. She does have that moment
with the horse. That was the heart in the throat moment in the movie for me.
I was just reflecting just now how much, not you, Genevieve, you're too young, but how much the rest of us grew up watching Terry Garr be mom on film in movie after movie in that period, you know?
I really do feel like there's a lot here to read between the lines. Like, I don't know about you guys, but when I watch her in that performance and what she's given, I draw in my mind this whole picture of a woman who possibly still loved her husband, but was possibly estranged from him. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't know why he's traveling with the boy. She manifests grief for her husband, but it's not any kind of deep, profound grief. It's kind of a sad, well, I wish you could have saved him too. And then she lives in this like fancy kind of over-decorated, overstuffed house that feels like kind of the exact opposite of Hoyt Axton and his kind of ruffled gambling ways. And then when this boy shows up on her doorstep, she doesn't quite seem to know what to do with him. And it kind of seems to take her a while to decide that she wants to intervene and be like an active mom in his life. I feel like she was used to him being away with the husband and didn't quite have a relationship with him. Hmm. And that we see every moment of her building a new relationship with him on screen.
Interesting.
I like that interpretation. Yeah.
We talk a little about the style of the film, and in the same interview with Scott Foundas that I mentioned before, Ballard likens his style to being a good fisherman, someone who can sit there and watch the fish come up to them, take the bait and not take it, go away, sit there another hour, hope that maybe it will come back. Is this careful approach? Do you kind of sense that watching this film? And I also found myself thinking, what would someone like your David Finchers or your Stanley Kubricks do trying to make a film like this? Like, this is a filmmaker who, by the nature of the project he chooses, has to work with elements he can't control.
I mean, I don't see him working here with elements he can't control. I see him working with some really surprisingly well-controlled elements. Again, kind of like reading up on the history of the film, they used a lot of different horses to be the black, and they each kind of had specialties. You know, there were the swimming horses and the lying on the ground thrashing around horses and the running horses.
The snake stopping horses.
So, I mean, that speaks
to... They were all painted black and to various degrees.
including some straight up white ones.
Yeah, the swimming horses were white.
Which, I don't know. Of course, the ones that they had to full body paint black were the ones that had to be in the water.
Yeah.
But I mean, that just kind of speaks to someone who is like taking a lot of control steps. At the same time, I try to imagine Stanley Kubrick doing that, like hand feeding the horse on the beach scene, like 67 takes. And I can't even imagine. I mean, who knows how many takes that took, but it's such a magical, it's one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen on film.
Absolutely. I love that scene. But no matter what, no matter how well-trained the horse is, though, there is an element of unpredictability. I mean, this is a filmmaker who worked with horses and wolves.
And kids.
And kids and geese, you know, and a cheetah.
And pigs. Don't forget pigs.
Right, and pigs.
Pigs.
There's an exclamation point in that title, which is why we're seeing it like pigs.
And we're excited about these pigs. But by definition, he's giving up a certain amount of, I'm trying to avoid using the word control again, but nonetheless, control what he's filming.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think the answer to your question is Kubrick wouldn't have made this movie.
Right.
Or wouldn't have made a movie with these elements, because it just wouldn't have fit with the way he worked. I mean, it also wouldn't have fit with the things that he's interested in.
Sure.
Ballard's career is so much about the interaction of people and nature, and like how wild animals behave and how that makes you feel. I mean, he basically had to be who he was to make these movies.
Yeah, I mean, the Ballard style sounds a lot like the Malick style, right? I mean, both of these are men who are constantly in search of the transcendent, specifically as it relates to the natural world. And if that means waiting until magic hour, they're going to do it.
You know, and also people are in some ways okay with finding their film in the editing room as well.
Yeah, because I mean, this is a very structured work. I mean, you could certainly think of it in two very distinct parts, you know, and it feels planned out very meticulously in some respects, and then in others it really opens up to whatever magic is created by nature and by Ballard's collaboration with Caleb Deschanel, who's an incredible photographer and gets some great images. And
I mentioned the sound designer before, but the sound designer is Alan Splett, whose other major collaboration is with David Lynch and Terrence Malick, too. The two films he made preceding this were Days of Heaven and Eraserhead.
Oh my gosh,
wow.
Well, you don't get better than the sound in Eraserhead.
Right.
Also, just watching this in tandem with Pete's Drag, I mean, this is something I knew, but it just really drove home the physicality of pre-CGI filmmaking and the quality that brings to it. Because, I mean, the dragon in Pete's Dragon is a wonder of, you know, CGI animation, whatever. Like, it's a great, I think it's a wonderfully realized character. But it's a character that can be manipulated and made to do whatever needs to be done. And that is not the case with this. Like, even if you are doing multiple takes with different horses and, you know, waiting for just the right moment, like, there is still just a unpredictability to that that just adds an extra level of...
How did they do that in the movie?
Like a certain texture to it.
But I'm just thinking about that scene of Alec riding bareback through the water. Like, I mean, Kelly Reno grew up on a ranch. Like, he knew how to ride horses. Like, that is really going on there. And like, I was a little distracted just like kind of thinking about the, like, what safety precautions are in effect here? Are there any? Or, you know,
well, the water is there to catch his fall.
Exactly. The water's there to catch his fall. I couldn't help but think about the physicality of riding a horse bareback in like thin pajamas.
Yeah,
that looked painful.
but just watching these two films in tandem, it really kind of served to highlight what each approach brings to the table.
So let's maybe loop back to that interview that Lowry gave with IndieWire about the sort of the dividing between art house and mainstream kids movies. And I think it's fair up to a point, but The Black Stallion wasn't exactly an ordinary kids film then. It stood out. It came out around the same time as a movie called Chomps, starring Valerie Harper and a robot dog. You know, kids were being pandered to then as now. Why do you feel there's a reluctance to bring sort of a touch of artful filmmaking to kids movies?
Because artful filmmaking is so associated with some kind of like egg-headed, brainy elitism in just like a really boring way. I mean, I think there's an assumption that, oh, well, you know, kids can't handle that. Kids need something loud and dangling, like jerking up and down in front of their faces. They need
Kevin
to be,
Spacey as a talking cat.
They need to be distracted at every moment. And, you know, they want everything go, go, go. And it's almost like the people that make these films don't remember being kids at all.
Yeah, it's the assumption that movies or entertainment exist as child distraction devices rather than actual art that a child can take in and appreciate.
I mean, in my experience, I think kids are more adventurous viewers than adults. You know, the thing about kids, in my experience as a dad, is that they accept the premise that you give them because they don't know enough about the world to reject it. When my daughter was little, her favorite movie was My Neighbor Totoro, which may seem too slow and abstract for someone of a young age to buy, or certainly of an older age, even harder. But I think that's precisely wrong. Kids have not fully formed their idea of what a movie is like adults have. They may develop it later and resist films that don't conform to their more calcified ideas about what to expect. But something like The Black Stallion, if you see it at a certain age, or you know, or if you want to show your kids a black and white movie, for example, or I mean, that's the time to do it when they're nice, when they're young, and they're not, you know, weaned on loud, clutter-filled garbage.
I think you also just can't overestimate the degree to which kids want to see kids on screen doing things that they would want to do. I mean, you look at films that are out right now, like Morse from America or Hunt for the Wilder People. You know, those are films, both films that adults can appreciate, but I feel like the ideal target for either of those movies would be a 13-year-old because that's what you're seeing on screen. I mean, now, from everything I've read, kids often like seeing kids that are just a couple years older than they are because it's aspirational. So maybe 11-year-olds rather than 13-year-olds, and maybe in this case, 7-year-old rather than a, like, what, roughly 9-year-old. But, I mean, I saw this as a little kid, and I wanted to be this kid. I wanted to be in this adventure. I wanted to be part of this story. I never had that reaction to things like The Cat from Outer Space or Pete's Dragon or whatever, because those stories didn't feel like something that could happen. You know, they didn't feel immersive.
All that being said, kids do like crappy movies. You know, let's not get too romantic. Not get too romantic about this.
I mean, I have to ask, have any of your kids seen The Black Stallion?
I think my five-year-old's just a tad too young for this one, but we went to see Pete's Dragon together. She loved it.
Yeah, I'm anxious to show my eldest, who's 8.
She's going
to
want a horse. Think carefully.
She's not getting one too ever, so she'll have to learn how to deal with loss. But yeah, I don't...
That's also a good thing for children.
That is a good
movies.
Thing. But no, I do intend to show Black Stallion to both of the kids. And they just watched Babe. They loved it. It was great.
Well, you know, something else about showing this movie to kids is it's a gateway drug to the book series.
Which I was going to ask you about. I haven't read any of them.
Oh, yeah. I was totally into them. There's this whole thing about like little girls and horses. Like certain little girls get super obsessed with horses. And I was never that kid. Like I didn't I didn't have the giant collection of like the Breyers like collectible horses. But I knew people that did. There's just like a certain type of little girl like seizes on the power and the majesty of the horse in some way that always escaped me. But I was super into books, and I was especially into books that was like a long continuity having series that could unfold. And the Black Stallion books, I mean, there were a lot of them, and they kind of sprawled outward into the Black Stallion verse. So, you know, it's a pity that Ballard,
coming soon to a theater near
Ballard you. Did not, in fact, make the Black Stallion cinematic universe. You know, they were probably looking back on it, not like terrific books, and they got weird really fast. Possibly even the next book in the series after The Black Stallion, this evil Arab shows up and says that horse is mine and like takes him back to Far Araby, and Alec goes there and like gets involved in intrigue, and it's all very not Ballard-y.
Yeah, they made that as a movie, Two Black Stallion Returns.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, and I saw it as a kid, and I remember thinking, this isn't so great. It's really not so great. And I think that's also a film that's somewhat notorious for animal abuse on the set, if I'm not mistaken. I could be mistaken.
I did have to stop this movie during the scene where the Black's like rolling around on the island covered in rope and just check to see kind of what its history with animals was. Because it was making me kind of uncomfortable.
And?
Apparently, I mean, by all claims, no animals were harmed in the making of this movie. And that was a trained horse that was really good with that particular trick.
It's the Marlon Brando of horses.
Oh, so it was fat and drunk and refused to learn its lines?
It was the early Marlon Brando of horses.
Let's circle back to what we kind of started talking about, the two halves of this film. I found them much better integrated this time watching it than before, because I really do feel like there's so many nice rhymes between the first half and the second half, that there's that Terry Garr moment that mm-hmm. you mentioned. I love the editing choice to cut back to the scene on the beach at the moment of victory. I mean, it just kind of collapses the time between those two things until they become the one thing. To me, the second half is, well, they're both unlikely, I guess. You know, real life is kin to the source. They're not getting off that island. But this sort of very unlikely unknown racer who is obviously a child is allowed to race against the West Coast and the East Coast champions. This isn't happening either. But
Keith,
but,
he's wearing a mask. How
that's
they
true.
Know?
That's true.
Are you aware that jockeys are small?
Yeah, that's true. They're not that small. they're not that small.
I mean,
small.
There's a whole scene where we establish that they're not that small.
Yeah.
Which, as a kid, I always found the second half kind of boring. But I love that scene where he walks in and gets on the scale. And the official says, will the jockey please get on the scale? Like, just that image of him, you know, standing there with all of his dressage stuff, like, in his hands, and he still doesn't really rate on the scale, like, tickled me a lot as a little kid.
Yeah, and it's shot in its own way just as lyrically as the stuff on the beach, too. I mean, the draw horse coming out of the mist, you know, it's so gorgeous. This movie, both halves are so, so beautiful.
Although, what is up with the extremely magical Black man?
Yeah, with the white horse.
With the white horse who's apparently like a horse whisperer, and then it's just kind of there at
yeah,
the end.
Yeah,
like,
brings his horse to the horse race to watch.
To watch. And talks to his horse who is wearing a Napoleon hat and is named Napoleon.
He gets that nice speech, though, that kind of draws out some of the themes of the film, where it kind of warns Alec that the horse can't be tamed, and kind of realizes he's really not trying to tame the horse ultimately. He's trying to live with the horse.
Well, and at the end, like, Mickey Rooney hugs him. I mean, he kind of brings him in a very inclusive way. And it kind of feels like, watching it now, like he was meant to be possibly a slightly subversive element for 1979. You know, here's this Black character who is like wise and present and involved and knows more than most of the adults involved and is like very actively included in the big victory at the end. I mean, it feels like it was meant to be a statement. It looks a little odd today.
We should mention that actor is Clarence Muse. This is his final role. But his history in film goes back to the 1920s, really one of the first sort of name African-American actors. Prior to this, he'd just been in Car Wash. So he's definitely an accomplished figure, and it seems like a nice final role for him. While we're talking, we should talk about Mickey Rooney, who got an Oscar nomination for this and kind of circles back to his own history with being in National Velvet. And I think he's terrific in this.
Yeah, he
movie.
Really is. It's a surprising performance, I think. Based on what we know or understand about Mickey Rooney, it's not shticky in any way.
Yeah, it's very dialed down.
Very much so, and soulful and wounded. And yeah. I think that's a real character. And I mean, you think about Mickey Rooney as being sort of goofy, or maybe even just being kind of a pro, who, you know, an entertainer. Mm-hmm. And there's something more layered about what he does here that I think is terrific.
There's also, I mean, he's kind of a visual gag. Like, when he's lurking in the dark and you can't see him, and he is threateningly claiming the horse over and over, he's a spooky figure. And then he steps out, and not only is he Mickey Rooney, but he's Mickey Rooney with shaving cream all over his face. And it kind of like deflates the moment and like takes him back to being just this kind of human who like the boy can interact with almost on his own level.
Yeah, the second half does feel like a showcase for him in that performance, which may be another kind of contributing factor to why it felt to me like the two halves didn't necessarily go together. Although, Keith, your keynote at the beginning in mentioning that final scene did kind of make it fit together a little better in my mind. But I guess a sticking point to me with the second half is that in order to like process this as a positive outcome or a happy ending, I think you have to buy into the idea that being a racehorse is the best possible thing that a wild horse could end up being. And I just don't necessarily believe that. And like, just because the black is fast doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to enjoy racing or all the things that come with. I mean, he's a wild stallion. He should be galloping over the plains, you know? And I spent a lot of time thinking about this because I was like, are you just finding a reason not to like this because you don't like horse racing? But like, if I was going to place logic on the black becoming a racehorse, it's like, okay, he can't live in the backyard. He needs to live on a farm, somewhere where he can run. And that is Mickey Rooney's farm, you know, and he can gallop across the pasture there and whatever. He can be happy. But Mickey Rooney can't afford it or something. So they need to like win a cash prize and they'll race him for that. Like that, at least I could buy is a reason to put him into racing. But it seems just like, well, he's fast, so we got to make him a racehorse.
Well, but I just consider it maybe as a part of his integration into the civilized world. I mean, think of it like
he's a wild horse.
Yeah, but why do we want to integrate him into the civilized world?
Yeah, like I understand. What is good about I understand that? That is the big theme of this, but I don't know that that is a theme that I want to see realized.
Well, I mean, I think you can reckon. He gets at this perfect moment in the race where he's still wild. He's still a horse. He's still got this incredible
bleeding profusely spirit. From the leg.
And yeah, he's got grit. He's got all of these things, but he's also kind of a part of our world as well. There's a reconciliation, I suppose, between the human world and the animal world. They sort of come together in this very exciting way. You know, and I just think horse races, there are crude way as human beings to measure the magnificence of a horse. You know, a horse that can do that is revered in a way that a horse.
But why do we care as an audience? I mean, we've already been privy to this incredibly intimate and beautiful mm-hmm. like rapprochement between the kid and the horse. We know it's a magnificent creature.
Yeah.
Why do we care that he's proved to be a magnificent creature to a bunch of people who just want to profit off of him and commodify him?
I think it's more a matter of finding a way that the boy and the horse can live together and have an existence together.
Right. And it's really about redemption more than money too, right?
In what sense?
I mean, for Mickey Rooney, I mean, I never really thought like, oh boy, now everyone's going to get rich off of this horse. That never really crossed my mind.
I mean, yeah, Mickey Rooney kind of does his like, I need this, but I don't feel like the film earns that enough. Like, I like his character, and you can certainly, you know, if you can make Terry Garr into a woman struggling to understand her son and come to terms with their new relationship, you can certainly make Mickey Rooney some sort of like well-realized man with a past that he's had to reject. I mean, he's kind of like Mr. Incredible from The Incredibles, you know, being invited back into the game that he loves, complete with his like hidden room full of trophies that he sighs over. But at the same time, like, again, it's not his story. It kind of feels like he comes out of nowhere and kind of attaches mm-hmm. himself to this. And the fact that the boy and the horse can be together in civilization, but only under this really regimented sort of way that requires gatekeepers and is like literally limited to like, here's your 2 miles. That's what you
get. How regimented are we talking here? I mean, like, there's nothing conventional in any way, shape, or form about the way the horse gets into the race, about the way the horse runs the race, about the way the horse wins the race. I mean, it's almost like you do have this system that is very orderly, and then just you're introducing this exciting chaos element into it. It's like the hippie crashing the party. It's this hippie horse. Plus,
he does
have
very long hair.
He's got really long. He really does. He's got long
hair. Kind of tangled and unwashed too.
Yeah, right.
I really just
defend it flat out as just being a thrilling sequence. I love his come from behind victory. I think this is a sporting thing. It's kind of great to watch. But
that kind of amazing come from behind victory happens a lot in horse racing, right?
That's when you've got this amazing horse. The other thing I have to mention, if we're going to do the first half, second half comparison, and again, I mean, you just can't beat the purity of the stuff on the island. I mean, that's as good as Sydney gets. So how are you going to even follow? Everything's going to be an anticlimax next to that. But
it's half of the film then is an anticlimax.
I'm saying in comparison, but the second half is quite good. And so I will say, yeah, we've mentioned many of the things I really like about the second half, but we haven't talked about the black galloping through this, you know, American city of the 40s and, mm-hmm. and beyond, and through industry and through the countryside, and it's just like this incredible image of the country at that time. It's just it's awesome.
Leaping
it's almost like misplaced
cars from the 1950s.
It just reminded me of like it was like watching Days of Heaven or something, mm-hmm. or like some incredible period piece as seen through this horse who's in a very, you know, different place than he's used to being in a civilized world with fruit carts and
It is in miniature, kind of the version of the short film you made, Perils of Priscilla, except with the horse instead of the cat. It's actually all on the Blu-ray. I can't sing the praises of this Blu-ray enough because it has all his short films, really good interviews with him. But yeah, very much worth taking a look at.
Yeah, I mean, I can't fault the beauty of the second half. I mean, that image of Clarence Muse and Napoleon the horse coming, like, slowly emerging mm-hmm. from the mist. I mean, like, that is some, like, Terry Gilliam-level beauty going on right there. It's not that it's not excitingly shot or well-paced or well-executed or emotional or emotive. I just keep wondering, like, well, what is it exactly that I'm supposed to be feeling here compared with the purity and the elegance of the first half of the film.
Yeah, the romance of horse racing just can't hold a candle to the romance of what is happening on that island. And I totally buy your guys' explanation, and especially Keith, I like what you just said about finding a way for the two of them to continue to be together, you know, and this being that way. But it can't feel like anything but a letdown after seeing their life on that island. And logically, obviously, that isn't a life that they could sustain, but their life in civilization just seems like a pale reflection, I guess.
Here's the thing.
There's a lot of seaweed on that island. Yeah. They might have made a go of it, but...
Yeah.
What I remember from the books is a sense...
You eat the horse.
that does it for this episode of the Next Picture Show.
Good night, everybody. What I remember from the books, and this is a very vague and distant memory, so people who are reading them right now can feel free to yell at me and correct me. I remember there being a lot more about the Black wanting to race, about it being very clear that the Black enjoyed competition and that only the competition of the race, like, really spurs it. It's like it's a visceral thrill for the horse that the horse doesn't get in any other way. And what's missing for me from the second half is a sense of the horse's needs in all this. I mean, it's clear what Mickey Rooney is getting out of it. It's clear what the famous race announcer with the entourage of cars is getting out of it. It's even fairly clear what Alec is getting out of it. What I don't get is any sort of sense of, like, why this is good for the horse.
I'm going to say, point taken. Yeah, at the same time, I'm kind of praise Ballard for not attempting to portray what the horse is getting out of the because that might have been a little too hard.
I was just saying, what this movie needed was a talking horse.
All right. So that should probably wind down our discussion of the Black Stallion for right now.
You probably should have winded it down when we started talking about eating the horse.
But we'll be back in just a moment with feedback. We were kind of surprised not to get much feedback on our episode pairing The Dirty Dozen with Suicide Squad. Maybe everyone was too in awe of Suicide Squad's greatness.
I certainly was.
We did get this bit of theorizing, however, from Jacob in Midland, Texas.
Jacob writes that he has always been puzzled by the Dirty Dozen character of Sergeant Boren, played in the film by Richard Yekel. He's not one of the dozen, nor is he their leader. The most recent viewing cracked it open for him. Jacob writes, I realized he's there to represent the audience and how we view the prisoners throughout the movie. At the beginning, like the viewer, he's skeptical of the whole situation. He has no respect for them and seriously doubts their mission will have any sort of success. His orders are full of sarcasm and snark. As the story progresses, he starts to joke with them and care about them. In the Last Supper scene, we see him with a big smile on his face, taking a picture of the whole group to remember the time together. And during the final mission, for a few of the different deaths of the main cast, the film cuts to show his surprised or horrified reaction, mirroring many of the faces in the audience. Jacob goes on to note that Suicide Squad, quote, sort of combines Boren and Reisman in a single character with Rick Flagg.
If only Richard Yekel were around to play Rick Flagg. I think Scott at least would have found that more satisfying.
The problem is that Rick Flagg has so much of a story role. There are so many things he's supposed to be trying to do there that he doesn't really have the opportunity to just kind of like sit back and look at the Suicide Squad for us and tell us how to appreciate them. He's got like three different story functions at the same time.
He's
got
to figure out a comprehensive way to bore the audience to death watching him.
Well, you know, that just is what makes him a supervillain, the borer.
I do like that reading of Bowen, though. I'd have to go back and watch the film to kind of track that progression Jacob is talking about, but it definitely scans with my memory of the film.
Yeah, it does make me want to go back and watch the death scene specifically mm-hmm. for his reaction shots. Because, he does come across as kind of an audience avatar. Like he's kind of dutifully going along with the whole business, even though he's very dubious about it. But he's foregrounded an awful lot more than you would expect somebody of that character
exactly.
to be.
Exactly, especially with there being so many people in this cast to begin with. It's like, why is there this 13th person here? Like, there has to be a reason for it, so... Audience surrogate makes sense.
Yeah, I like this theory.
I'll buy it. So even if the Dirty Dozen and Suicide Squad didn't stir up a lot of action, we'll always have Ghostbusters to talk about.
Oh, yes, we will. Johnny S. wrote in to expand on a point we made, explaining how Ghostbusters' theme of gentrification bleeds beyond the borders of the film itself. He writes, "Not only does New Busters nicely capture contemporary New York's ambivalence about its own past, but it pointedly refers to the city as a very different place than it used to be. I'm thinking specifically about that baffling time warp sequence at the end. More importantly, the movie is a kind of gentrified object too, all sanitized, nostalgic posturing without a hint of danger. That's not to say that the original isn't worth cleaning up. It's less funny or scary than it is big. But the interesting part is that the movie underwent its own version of sanitization too. What started as a product of SNL's anarchic sensibility veered off course when Belushi died and Murphy declined. This kind of cultural gentrification, making the present safer at the expense of the past, is slowly becoming the norm. You see the same thing in comic book movies, and as much as I love Star Trek Beyond, that show's rougher edges were part of its charm. Like real-life gentrification, it may be progress, but I wouldn't call it progressive, and in the case of a female-led blockbuster, that's a shame."
So the point here being that films like Ghostbusters and Star Trek Beyond, that they lose some of the shagginess of the originals, and that Ghostbusters itself isn't the shaggy anarchic film it might have been if Belushi had stuck around and Eddie Murphy had been in it. It's an interesting argument. What do you guys think?
I really don't want to see the version of original Ghostbusters with Belushi and Murphy at this point. You know, I think we established at great length our feelings, our positive feelings and negative feelings for that film. But it is a document of its time in a really interesting way. And I just have to think that the anarchic Belushi version would have been, you know, shaggier and even more ego-focused in a way that would have taken away from the ensemble, which is what makes that film so great.
Mm-hmm. But in general, do you feel that the remakes kind of shave off the rough edges and the reboots and whatnot? Star Trek in particular?
Oh, absolutely. No, I think it's very true of Ghostbusters, too. I mean, I think that there is actually a sense of weirdness and uncanniness and danger in the original Ghostbusters that's just completely lacking in the remake.
I was kind of joking after seeing Star Trek Beyond that it was the sort of movie that would take the old Star Trek, you know, give it like a wedgie or something. It's just, it's like, it's not as nerdy as the, it's much slicker and piece of polish, and it feels in certain ways not like a Star Trek movie at all. But I saw it a second time. Yeah. and really softened to it quite a bit, and saw a lot of soul in the relationship between the characters and their camaraderie and teamwork that really kind of impressed me this time out. So.
Yeah, I like that movie. And actually, I think what you said of that could probably be said of every Star Trek movie except for the first one, Star Trek The Motion Picture, which really does feel like an episode of the show.
Well, you're bullying Star Trek 4.
No, I think Star Trek 4, though, is definitely more, you know, movie first. Okay. You know, satisfying the needs of a big summer science fiction movie.
Is it movie first, though? I mean, to me, it feels like era first. It feels like just such a weird experiment in, let's just get all of these characters that you like together now, like in the 80s, and like let them hang out. Because whatever, man.
I don't know. I like that movie.
I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm saying, like, first of all, I don't think it has the rough edges. And second of all, I do think that it would get dragged behind the school and given a swirly. Just, I mean, it's a weird small
movie.
I'm glad you're
connecting with this metaphor of my talk.
Yeah, I'm not even really sure what it means. I just like saying swirly.
As always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll plunge deep into a land where dragons dwell, or at least one especially kind-hearted dragon who sees a bit of himself in a little lost boy he decides to protect. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow or follow us on Twitter at nextpicturepod so you always know when a new episode drops. Until then, let's kick back and challenge some seaweed while we wait to be rescued.